Accession number 28651, Mr. Victor Berwick, Reel 5. Now, since we last met, you've drawn a diagram of the clockwork Vickers predictor, and I think it would be valuable for you to go through again. We'll put this diagram in the file so that people can get it out to consult it when they're listening to this. So if you start from the start of explaining this diagram.
First of all, the actual controls and brief operation of the predictor. As number one, directly we're on alert and aircraft were coming into sight, I would swing the predictor around by a certain clutch release through an open sight to get a rough bearing on the aircraft, with numbers 2 and 3, who were operating the elevation telescope and the bearing telescope, and they would report on target directly. It came into view on their two telescopes, and they would then take over.
Right. So what other? Do you want to carry on?
The next thing, of course, required would be the height of the aircraft, which, of course, was being ascertained by the height finder crew, which you will see here is a brief diagram of a height finder. It's the one we use by a firm called Barnes Stroud, a great optical firm. And three men would operate that, two and three on the telescopes, one elevation and one bearing. And they also would have been swung round on the rough bearing for the open sight. And number one, he had also a control. Now, it all works on prisms, because the actual size of the aircraft coming through the telescopes has got to be married up into one vision. And that's done by the number one through a series of prisms. And by turning his controls, he had two pictures of the aircraft, and he had to get them coincidental, so one actually sort of tied up with the other one. Once he had coincidence, and he could then read off on a scale, all done automatically by trigonometry, what the height of the aircraft was. That's roughly how it worked. And he would then report to the GPO height so-and-so. Before that, the GPO would have helped the predictor by looking at the height of the aircraft and making a rough estimate of height, which will be put in initially. The predictor would then be corrected once the height finder gave the true height. That height is then reported to the predictor crew, and that is numbers 4 and 5 on the predictor. Number 4, who is one on the fuse setting equipment. And there you have a revolving drum, which is revolving, tied up with the actual movement of the numbers 2 and 4 who are following the aircraft. And the drum consists of a graph actually on this drum, with a series of lines indicating the various heights. And the numbers 4 and 5 had pointers, which they were then set onto the height being announced. And they would follow that height by their controls. And each one would do that. And that would be passed through to the guns. Of course, the fuse would be determined by the rotation of that drum and the tangent elevation, which we require to give the correct angle on the guns. Of course, no good firing a gun direct onto an object. You've got to have an elevation to allow for gravity and everything else. And they would report of so-and-so set, the height set, and then one will carry on until they've lost the target or was shot down. Right, I should have mentioned earlier that a very vital piece of information came through every day from the gun operations room, and that was weather conditions. It was very vital that we knew what the barometric pressure was, and also the wind direction.
morning.
Yes, we were. It might be once or twice a day, according to weather conditions. At least once a day, we had barometric pressure. And that was necessary because the atmospheric pressure would affect the actual burning of the fuse. The fuse would be burning, I forget which way it goes, it's all probably a question of oxygen in the air, at a faster or slower rate. And so we had to work out what's called a fuse factor, which was the job of the GPOAC, directly as the information came through, there was a certain formula, working out the fuse factor, which was applied to the fuse setting device on the guns, which either increased the burning rate or lowered it. The other thing being wind direction also could affect the trajectory of the shell by blowing it off course. And there was a dial on a predictor in which that wind direction would be set, and that would add the correction necessary.
Now, that was just a sort of sidestep. Anything else about you? What we were talking about before was your time, of course, at Manston. I wonder, is there anything else you recall about your time there? I think we'd almost covered it. You were there between May and October 1940.
One thing happened on a weekend leave. We got the odd weekend leave, not often, but I was home in Ashford on one particular Saturday. It's just only one night off. I had to report back on the Sunday. And it was on a Sunday afternoon, around about 3 o'clock, and there had been no alert at all of any enemy aircraft over Ashford. And when Sunday I was in the garden in Church Road, Ashford, and I heard the whistling of a bomb. And I immediately rushed indoors and told the family to get down when everything went up. And this bomb landed 60 feet from the house where I was. It demolished a couple of semi-detached houses, and I was living in a second house of a terrace of four, and it blew out the end of the end of the terrace and rather badly cracked the house where I was living. And so I immediately contacted the battery saying that I wanted a little compassionate leave to sort out the family's affairs. So I was given 2 days, 2 days leave to get that done. But luckily nobody was killed. The two houses which were empty, which were semi-detached, were empty. And also the end of the terrace house.
And this was Church?
Church Road, Ashford. Now the site of the county library.
Now, anything happened while you were, anything else you recall about your time at Manston? I think we've discussed most of the stories you've got in your notes.
No, I can't think of anything else at the moment at all. The only thing was the flat-headed shot, which was something.
The what?
The flat-headed shot. It's in the notes down there, you'll find. It was a special shell we were issued with to combat enemy vehicles or tanks if they made a landing. And they were a solid projectile with no high explosive content, but the end was cut off with a sort of flat surface. Where the nose cone or the fuse normally would be, it was just a flat head. And when they were never used, we don't know how effective they would have been.
Now, so what? So you were there until October. Were you always in tents, or did you?
No, we did get Nissen huts erected at a later stage in the summer.
Was that better, or?
Oh yes, it was better. Oh yes. Although it had been a beautiful summer, we didn't really suffer in the tents. Yes, there's one thing I just thought about. Yes.
What's that?
Talking about being a sergeant, we did have a sergeant's mess, which was off the gun site, and it was in the gardens of a very nice house not far away, just across the road, which was occupied by a certain Lady Carson. Now, she was rather a remarkable person, of course. She used to come out in her own tin hat to watch us in operation. But also, she was the widow of Lord Carson, who was one of the founders of the Northern Ulster, or the Northern Ireland, when the breakaway from the Republic took place. And I find that you find in the records that he took a very leading part, Lord Carson.
And what was the sergeant's mess like?
Very, very basic, very just a trestle table, an odd chair or two, and a very, very rough bar, which one of the sergeants kept going.
Now, what happened when you moved? You moved in October.
One other point, Lady Carson very kindly let the sergeants have the use of her tennis court.
Now, where did you move to in October? It looks like you go to Derby.
Went to Derby.
Now, what was this posting?
They have to cover the Rolls, well, cover Derby and the Rolls Royce works, which were actually on the outskirts of Derby.
And do you remember what the gun positions were like?
We took over four 3.7s, which was a static site, based near Mark Eaton Park, in Derby, with a drill hall nearby as well. The Army drill hall was quite close. But it was not a very good site. It's very low-lying, and we had a lot of snow soon after we arrived, or later on after we arrived in the winter, and we suffered a lot of flooding, so much so that the command post and the gun position were underwater. And there being a static site, the command post had a low dug-in point where the leftness sat and so forth, and the duty the officers were, and we had to sleep on trestles above the water. It was very dank. We got the fire brigade down to pump us out, which did lower the level of water. And there, of course, it was all night action. Having had day action down in Kent, we now had days free, and any action at night was, of course, the night raids.
Now, what were the night raids like?
Mainly, we were working on instructions from the gun operations room in the form of barrages. We were given coordinates, which gave us bearing and heights and so forth, so that we were firing mainly barrages.
Now, can you explain to them what a barrage is? It's a different print. You're not aiming at the aircraft.
No, you can't see the aircraft, because at that time, even then, we weren't able to operate at night. Although later on, with a more advanced radar, when they could give heights and so forth, we could operate in the dark.
But at this stage, it was just a matter of putting up a wall of shells.
That's right. Yes.
Now, do you remember any of the specific raids? How bad were they?
Actually, we didn't suffer any raid at all. The only one big scare we had was that the powers that be had a means of detecting where raids were going to take place, done by a system of radio beams, which the Germans were sending. If the Germans were going to bomb a certain industrial area, they had two radio beams from different sites onto that actual target, and a crossing point on the target would be indicated in aircraft that were coming to bomb. They would follow the beam until the intersecting beam gave a signal in the aircraft, and that was where they were to release their bombs. And our intelligence had worked out and discovered these beams, and they could find that the beams would be in operation before in daybreak. And we had a scare one night saying the beam is intersecting over Derby. And so we had masses of ammunition brought in from the ammunition dump, but it didn't happen. We had no raids all the time. We were at Derby at all. The only other scare was that we moved from Mark Eaton Park out to an outlying area called a village called Haddiston. So we had to take our guns out there, and on a rather boggy piece of ground, and before we could go in any sort of operation, we had to have moved in tons of rock and other hardcore to make firm, very firm foundations for the guns. Otherwise, they would, it would just sink and wouldn't be effective because the levelling would go out of gear. And the other thing was, of course, that a matter of about possibly half a mile, nearly, or might be a mile away, was I forget what the term they used, but it was a series of big flares that they could ignite at night if they wanted to give the Germans the impression that they had hit a target which had been set on fire. And there was a series of pipelines right across the field which were oil-fired, and they could ignite these pipes, giving the evidence of a blaze, and the Germans would bomb them, you see, but we weren't very unhappy because it was not very far from us, and if the Germans started bombing the blaze, we would also get a bit of a backlash from it, which wasn't pretty, but anyway. The other thing, of course, Derby was fitted with what they call smoke pots, also to try and hide any target or evidence that they'd hit a target. And the streets were lined, I forget the distance between the various pots, but there'd be quite a few pots on each street. They were metal tubs filled with a very thick oil, which they used to ignite, and gave off dense, dark black smoke, which sort of completely obliterated the sky, and so Germans couldn't see any result of any bombing.
Anything else about your time at Derby? Not much happened there from the sound of it.
That was very quiet, no.
So they just didn't raid Rolls-Royce during that period?
No, I don't know if they ever did.
And you were there from October to December, from the looks of it?
Yes.
And that's when you moved to Rawmarsh?
Yes, the gun position was at a village called Rawmarsh, which was just west of Rotherham, which was a very big industrial area with the steel mills and chemical works.
And what was the gun position like there?
There we took over the big static 4.5s, which were mounted. The gun position was mounted on a very old coal slag heap. But it had been there for many years, so it was perfectly solid. It didn't sort of give under the repercussion of the firing.
Now, anything happened here? Anything you remember about this?
No. We had very, very few raids there. Because, actually, I left Rotherham when I went for commissioning to Shrivenham.
That looks like in April. So you were there about 5 months. Anything happened at Rotherham at all, or is it just very quiet?
Very quiet. That was all barrage work.
And what was barrage work like? I mean, was it harder work? You just had to pump shells,
I suppose. Yeah, until they gave an order to cease fire.
Now, what's the background to you taking a commission? I mean, whose idea was it? What happened?
One of the officers, well, funny enough, I had been, when we were down in Kent, I was selected to go up for commissioning, and I had to report to the Chelsea Barracks with another NCO from the battery, and I was a sergeant, and the other chap was a bombardier with two stripes. And I reported to the board, of course, went in singly, asked about background, education, life in general, schooling, and also, of course, I had my record from the TA. But I was really disappointed not to be selected. But the other chap who went with me was. And although he was lower rank, and I rather fancy the reason why he possibly got the got selected was the fact that he had been a steward on a cruise liner. And of course, in his explanation of what he'd been doing, he served on certain ships, and one of the interviewing board, well, I know that ship well, you see. And I rather fancy it might have just tipped the scales in his favour. But I may be wrong.
So you failed that time. Yeah. Now, how did you come to get on this time?
Well, this time we were at Rotherham or Royalmarsh, and I went to Selby, where there's a famous Abbey at Selby, and sailed through there. No problem.
And what do you remember of that? It just went better, did it? Were you more mature?
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
and also the questioning was different. They asked more about the technical side of gunnery, which I felt wasn't done the first time.
Now, what was your attitude to taking a commission? Did you automatically think it was a good idea, or did you think it over a bit?
No, I was very keen. I'd always been a bit ambitious.
Now, what happened? Where did you go then?
Went to Shrivenham. No, first of all, I was ordered to go to Llandudno of Wales, which is on the Welsh borders. There was an octave there, but it was rather spread out because all the cadets were housed in hotels. And then there was the actual training area with not very good accommodation and buildings. And I was only there roughly a week when I was asked to report with a detachment of, I think, about 20 of cadets to go to Shrivenham. And I was given given charge of taking this detachment by train to Shrivenham, and lost one chap in Shrewsbury. The trains only went as far as Shrewsbury. We had to change trains there, and we had a certain time to have a look at the town and have a meal. But one individual failed to report back when we caught the next train to Shrivenham. Anyway, he eventually arrived.
And what was the setup at Shrivenham? Do you know which really number good. It was, or was it just octave?
No, it was purposely built. It was quite a new erection, all brand new buildings, more or less. But it's been two units. One was called the Watson Unit, and the other Beauregard, Beauregard. Names of famous generals in the British Army at some stage. They weren't known to me. But they were identical units, but separated. And the whole thing was run on the lines of really a good boarding school. We had dormitories. And, of course, there's lots of spit and polish. These dormitories had to be absolutely pristine. The floors had to be polished every day. And the beds had to be in certain trim. And blankets... You were given name tags for your blankets, which had to be sewn on, and then the blankets had to be folded in a certain way so that the name tags, one above the other, were to the fore, and so anybody inspecting the room could see who was a delinquent in some way.
Would you get kit inspected at the same time as a room inspection?
No, that was done when we were out of the room. So what happens, the polishing of the floor was one thing, so you never walked over the floor. Once it had been done, you just hop from bed to bed to get to the door. Also, the bucket, there was one bucket and a mop, which the bucket had to be actually polished with a metal, what's the term, scrubbing surface. So it really did gleam. And even the mop handle was scraped with razor blades, so it looked nice and white and clean, such as army life it was. Anyway, it's part of the discipline.
And what about your uniform? Do you have to polish your boots up and everything?
Oh yes, it was all a recognised thing.
Now, what was the training like? Take me through the training. What exactly did they train you in?
Well, everything required to be an officer and a gentleman, because we were a mixed bag. there were various professional classes, lawyers, accountants, like myself, and so forth. And one of our instructors, the Offer instructor, he was also a chartered accountant, so that when he knew I was an accountant, he was quite interested. But no, we had, it's split in two phases. One was lecturing on all phases of army behaviour and discipline and so forth. And then the other was, of course, the gunnery year, which where we went to a special gun park and operated on the guns and the equipment.
What, tell me about the gun training, because,
well,
what do you remember of it in any detail?
Mainly, it's from the officer point of view. We had plenty of action on the real thing, so that from the operation of the actual equipment, they couldn't teach us anything.
Was it just anti-aircraft guns, and or was it?
Oh yes. It was a special college for anti-aircraft. It is now, I'd like to make it know, it is now called the Royal College of Military Science.
So you knew all the guns that you were introduced.
Yes. Yeah. Although we were thoroughly tested on it, it wasn't taken for granted. Because I remember on one particular test taking place, operating as a team, that one of my fellow cadets didn't know his predictor drill, and he had his what's the term?
Crib notes.
Crib square. His crib actually written on the back of his hand, which I thought was pretty poor.
Anything happened there? Anything you remember about the time there?
Of course, we did a certain amount of infantry training as well. We
how much?
Not a great deal, but it was about a second rate thing. It was a bit incidental.
Platoon infantry training.
Yeah.
What did that cover?
Just make it of an army unit, so the actual numbers and battalion formation, company formation, but down to platoon level and sections. It was very, very, very basic. No, we went on night schemes, taking guns out on night exercises.
What were they like, a night exercise?
Well, bit hairy, because in those days there were no signposts, and in rather strange country, and I was given the job of leading a convoy out to a certain position, and I just myself and the driver leading the convoy, and I misread the map, carried on, but the driver in the next the next one in the convoy, he knew I'd gone wrong, you see, but he took the right turn. So there was I with no convoy, and realised that, and eventually got there and found the guns and everything else had already arrived. But it didn't seem to upset my standing with the youth. But it was, it could have been a boob. But with no signposts and so forth, and the country lanes, it was one of those things in the dark. And my driver didn't let on. He knew we were okay.
Now, how were you assessed at the end of it all? I mean, you obviously passed. We were commissioned, but was there any particular assessment?
There was a rating, but I've forgotten. It was a sort of a number rating. I came out quite highly. I was very satisfied.
And was there a passing out parade?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember that? Not particularly.
No. Members of the family weren't invited. It was all very, very, very sort of military and just done.
So that was it? You were a second lieutenant?
Yeah.